Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
Last time, we talked about independent agencies and the basic structure, but we didn't really hit the removal power. That's what we're talking about today. So, Mark, did you ever coach your kids' soccer team when they were little?
Yeah. Have you never heard of the Islanders U-12 team that competed in the famed soccer championship of 2014? Well, they were just amazing. They ran all of the different formations. It was a fantastic team.
So I also coached Gabby's for years. I don't know how well the Rainbow Unicorns would have done against yours, but it was never something I was taking super seriously. That was definitely not universally true.
I mean, I've seen those parents, the ones yelling on the sideline about a terrible call or that a ref should be fired.
So can they fire the ref in those situations?
No, absolutely not.
All right. What about the crazy coach running the other team? Can they fire the ref?
Yeah, no, again, they don't have an unbiased judgment about the ref's performance.
Oh, definitely not. So what could get a ref removed in the middle of the game?
Well, I mean, you'd have to be something so far beyond the pale, like if you were caught taking a bribe from the other team. Maybe if you were, like, drunk on the field.
All right. Yeah, that could do it.
So, I mean, it would have to be really egregious.
Yes, it would. So notice the pattern here. We would need actual misconduct, not just bad calls. So legally, we would say this is malfeasance, neglect of duty, or inefficiency.
Not, I just disagree with your call, but you've literally stopped doing your job now.
Exactly. Actual misconduct. This came up because we had sort of the same issue in 1973, but the angry parent screaming fire the ref was the president of the U.S.
Nixon?
Nixon, indeed.
He kind of gives off that vibe.
I know. So instead of referee, it was the special prosecutor Archibald Cox, who was investigating Watergate. But Nixon didn't just yell fire the ref. He tried to actually do it.
So could he actually do it? Cox
wasn't an independent official with the statutory protections we've been talking about. He was a special prosecutor and had been appointed by the attorney general. So technically, he served at the pleasure of the attorney general.
So Nixon could fire him?
Not directly. He had to go through the attorney general.
What was Cox doing that Nixon wanted him gone?
Cox had subpoenaed the White House tapes at that point. Those are the recordings that would ultimately prove Nixon's involvement in the Watergate cover-up. And Nixon was trying to claim executive privilege. Cox threatened to take Nixon to court over this. And so Nixon decided the best way to fix this would be to get rid of Cox.
So what did Nixon do?
So Saturday, October 20th, he calls the attorney general and says, fire Cox.
So Richardson fired him?
No, Richardson refused. So he said, Mr. President, I appointed Cox with a promise of independence. I promised the Senate during my confirmation that Cox would have free rein. I can't fire him for doing exactly what he was appointed to do, investigate political crimes. And he resigned on the spot.
So he quit rather than fire Cox?
He did. So then Nixon calls the deputy attorney general, William Rackelhaus. Same order, fire Cox.
And let me guess, he refused as well.
He did. We don't quite have as elegant a speech prepared, but he refused and resigned. So Nixon's getting desperate, and he goes to the third in command, Solicitor General Robert Bork.
And Bork did it?
He did. He fired Cox that night. But this wasn't quietly letting somebody go. This was huge, public, and unprecedented. The press called it the Saturday Night Massacre.
Why a massacre?
Because in one night, Nixon has lost his attorney general, his deputy attorney general, and gotten rid of the special prosecutor investigating him. It looked exactly like it was, a president trying to shut down investigation into his own misconduct because it was going to find questionable stuff.
So how did people react?
The public was furious. Congress was flooded with telegrams. This was the most traffic Western Union had seen since the Kennedy assassination. Editorial boards across the country condemned him. In the next few days, they introduced multiple impeachment resolutions into the House. It was a disaster.
Yeah, nothing speaks vitriol like telegrams. But again, this was 1973.
It was. So within days, Nixon is forced to appoint a new special prosecutor with even stronger independent protection. And this would eventually lead to his downfall, and he resigned less than a year later.
And Cox didn't even have statutory independence protection.
No. And the point of this is to show how powerful that norm of independence was. Even without legal protection, firing somebody investigating you looked so corrupt that the political costs were devastating.
I noticed you said was, not is. Was that intentional?
Well, things seem to be a little different now.
Yeah. So you have stronger norms back in the day that dealt with this question of independence. Were the norms that strong?
They absolutely were, but this was also when we had a lot greater deference towards agencies in general. So after all of this happened, Congress went through and tried to make sure the special prosecutors were actually independent. They passed the Ethics in Government Act to create an independent counsel with actual statutory protection, and this was upheld by the Supreme Court in Morrison v. Olson, one of the most contested opinions in administrative law history.
Yeah, as I recall, the vote was 7-1. Scalia wrote the famous lone dissent, and he said, "This wolf comes as a wolf. He argued that an executive officer the president cannot control is fundamentally unconstitutional."
Yes. And again, at the time, that was a lone dissent, but the modern court now treats Scalia's dissent almost like gospel. Morrison technically is still good law, but it's been so undermined that most people would say it's effectively overruled. And that should give you some sense of where the court is heading on presidential power.
Okay, so let's get back to basics then. Let's be fundamentalists for a second. What does the Constitution actually say about the president's power to remove officials?
Almost nothing. Article 2 says the president has the executive power and must take care that the laws be faithfully executed. But virtually nothing on removal.
Nothing at all.
The closest is impeachment. But that's how Congress can remove the president, the vice president, and civil officers. Nothing about how the president could remove executive branch officials.
So why didn't the founders address this?
They debated it, but they couldn't agree. So they just didn't resolve it. Some thought the Senate should be involved in removal because the Senate was involved in confirmation. But other people thought that the president would need unilateral removal power. So they just kicked the can down the road.
Yeah, that seems like another thing that could have been in Hamilton. Easily.
That really could have. That was like Hamilton time. So yes, that would have been great to stick in.
I mean, that seems like a pretty important thing to leave out.
The first big showdown, though, didn't occur until 1926 in Myers v. United States. So I'm going to have you read a section of Chief Justice Taft's opinion. And it's worth remembering that by this point, Taft had already been president. So he had very strong views on presidential power.
So Taft wrote, "The power of removal is incident to the power of appointment, not to the power of advising and consenting to the appointment. And when the grant of the executive power is enforced by the express mandate to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, it emphasizes the necessity for including within the executive power as conferred the exclusive power of removal."
Taft is saying here that removal is inherently going to be part of the executive power. If the president can't remove officials, he can't really be the chief executive.
Well, that makes sense. How can you be the boss if you can't fire people?
That's certainly an argument, but there was another view. And again, this is why they couldn't agree. This is from Federalist 77, where Alexander Hamilton himself discusses this exact issue.
"The consent of the Senate would be necessary to displace as well as to appoint."
So Hamilton definitely thought the Senate should be involved in removal as well. If they have to confirm appointments, they should confirm removals too.
So even the founders disagreed.
Yes, this is why we don't have anything clear. They debated it for days, and then in the decision of 1789, they basically agreed the president had removal power, but it wasn't unanimous, and so it wasn't in the Constitution.
Let me give the presidential power argument its strongest form, because I think it's important to understand why this is still a serious constitutional theory today.
Yes, please do.
Okay, the Constitution vests all executive power in one person, the president. Not some of it, but all of it. If someone is executing the law, making decisions, enforcing rules, imposing penalties, that is executive power. That means the president must be able to remove them. Otherwise, you have executive power being exercised by people the president can't control, and the Constitution therefore never allows. You can't have a fourth branch of government that's neither legislative nor judicial nor truly executive. That is the unitary executive theory.
Exactly. You were hinting at it last episode, and there it is. This is exactly what the court is weighing right now in Trump v. Slaughter. Is this creating an unconstitutional fourth branch when it insulates these multi-member commissions? Or is this a reasonable compromise based on what we actually need to have a functional democracy with secure monetary policy?
So when these statutes say officials can be removed for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office, what does that actually mean? Those seem like pretty vague terms.
They are vague, and probably intentionally so, but malfeasance is the clearest. That's actual wrongdoing, like crime, corruption. If the Fed chair is taking bribes from banks to set favorable rates, that would be malfeasance. Clear grounds for removal, no one would dispute that.
So this is clearer than high crimes and misdemeanors.
Part of the problem is that if we're thinking about impeachment, that's being decided by a group, and it's based on whatever the group thinks. Whereas here, we're dealing with a decision by the president to remove. And again, the president can remove these people. They just have to do it for cause.
Okay, so what about neglect of duty?
This would just be not doing your job, not showing up to work, or refusing to make decisions, abandoning your responsibilities. If a member of the board just stopped showing up to work and doing anything, that would be neglect of duty.
So the referee who stops making calls in the middle of the game.
Yes. So those people are pretty in agreement on, but then it starts to get tricky with inefficiency. What exactly is inefficiency? Would it be incompetence, bad judgment? Could the president say that policy decisions he disagrees with are just inefficient?
Well, that seems like a huge loophole. I mean, couldn't a president just say your policies are inefficient and fire someone?
It's never really been tested in court. There were norms that had developed, but you can think of it like tenure for professors. So I'm tenured and you're my dean. Realistically, why could you fire me?
For not showing up to class, plagiarizing articles, deciding to start grading with a dartboard.
Yeah, so actual misconduct, not disagreement or controversy or citing too much reading.
So not convincing someone to do a podcast.
Fortunately.
Has this ever been tested? Has a president said, I think your policy decisions constitute inefficiency?
No. We came close in 2018. Trump was considering firing the Fed chair Powell over interest rate increases. And just the hint that this might happen caused the Dow to drop 350 points in minutes.
So the market still enforced the norm, even if the law is unclear.
The markets definitely have. The economic consequences of violating this independence would be immediate and severe. If we're allowing people to make these changes based on what politics demand, nobody's going to trust the market and the entire system will collapse.
Okay, so tell me about these close calls. When we have presidents that have actually tested the limits of removal power.
We'll start with FDR. This is 1933. He's just been elected. He's got big plans for the New Deal, and there's this federal trade commissioner named William Humphrey who's way too conservative.
So could Roosevelt fire him?
At that point, the FTC Act said commissioners could only be removed for cause. We read that last time. But FDR decided to test it. So he wrote Humphrey a letter. Could you read this part of it?
You will, I know, realize that I do not feel that your mind and my mind go long together on either the policies or the administrating of the Federal Trade Commission. And frankly, I think it is best for the people of this country that I should have a full confidence.
So here he's not even pretending there's cause. He's just saying, I'm firing you because we disagree.
Well, that's surprisingly honest.
It is. He thought honesty would be good enough. He thought the court would side with the presidential power. And he probably also just thought Humphrey would resign. So Humphrey refused and then died while the case was pending. And his executor continued the lawsuit. Hence, Humphrey's executor.
So what did the court then say?
This is before the switch in time that we talked about earlier. This was a unanimous decision against FDR. The court said the FTC exercises quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial powers, not purely executive functions, and that Congress could protect commissioners from removal. Here's the key part.
The authority of Congress in creating quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial agencies to require them to act in discharge of their duties independently of an executive control cannot well be doubted, and that authority includes, as an appropriate incident, power to fix the period during which they shall continue in office and to forbid their removal except for cause in the meantime. For it's quite evident that one who holds his office only during the pleasure of another cannot be depended upon to maintain an attitude of independence against the latter's will.
Again, by the time we heard this was 1935, the court was saying that agencies can be independent from the president. And not surprisingly, this made FDR furious and was part of what contributed to his war with the court and his court packing plans.
Okay, so what about more recent presidents?
We talked about Nixon earlier, but he had also pressured the Fed chair at the time to keep interest rates low before the 1972 election.
Wait, so how could he pressure Burns if he couldn't fire him?
Great question. So federal governors can only be removed for cause, so he couldn't fire him, but he did have other leverage.
Like what?
He controlled future Fed appointments. He could publicly attack Burns, making his life miserable. And unlike with Cox, this was all behind the scenes. He actually had regular meetings with him where he would pressure him repeatedly in person.
That seems really beyond the pale.
It does seem inappropriate, but it worked. Burns gave in, and interest rates stayed low through the election.
And Nixon won.
He won in a landslide, 49 states.
Wow. But what was the consequence?
Massive inflation through the 1970s.
How bad?
So in 1974, inflation was up to 11%. By 1980, it was almost 14%.
That's devastating.
It was terrible. A lot of economists blamed Burns' capitulation for some of the worst inflation in modern American history.
So what about even more recent examples, like this century?
We talked before about Trump's frustration with the Fed in his first term. He was frustrated the Fed was raising interest rates. He thought it was hurting the economy and his reelection chances.
And so what did he do?
So he started tweeting attacks on Powell, calling him an enemy of America, saying the Fed had gone crazy.
Could he actually fire Powell?
His advisors told him no. And the Federal Reserve Act says board members can only be removed for cause.
But he wanted to.
He definitely did. Reportedly, the Treasury Secretary had to talk him out of it multiple times.
So how did the markets react?
Every time rumor surfaced that Trump was considering this, stocks dropped.
How much?
December 2018 was the worst December for stocks since the Great Depression.
Just from the possibility that Powell might be fired.
Yes, the markets were saying, do not dare touch Fed independence.
And did Trump back down?
He eventually did. That's why we didn't have the cases in 2019. So, yes, the economic consequences were too severe, but never stopped criticizing Powell.
So that brings us to 2020, right?
It does. So in 2020, we have Celia Law v. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Congress had created the CFPB after the financial crisis. They created it with a single director who was supposed to serve a 5-year term and could be removed only for cause. And the court said this is a problem.
Because unlike the FTC, there aren't multiple commissioners, just one very powerful director.
Yes, we talked about this some last time, but now we're really going into why. Chief Justice Roberts laid out why the structure made the court nervous. Can you read the part here where it's talking about why a single director was such a problem?
The CFPB's single director structure contravenes this carefully calibrated system by vesting significant governmental power in the hands of a single individual accountable to no one.
That's the core concern. We have one person with huge authority and no real oversight.
And Roberts continues, the director is neither elected by the people nor meaningfully controlled through the threat of removal by someone who is. The director does not even depend on Congress for annual appropriations.
So we have no voters, no president, no Congress, no one providing democratic accountability.
Right. And then he describes what that director can do. Yet the director may unilaterally, without meaningful supervision, issue final regulations, oversee adjudications, set enforcement priorities, initiate prosecutions, and determine what penalties to impose on private parties.
This is an enormous amount of power for one unelected official.
And then the opinion sums it up. It says, with no colleagues to persuade and no boss or electorate looking over her shoulder, the director may dictate and enforce policy for a vital segment of the economy affecting millions of Americans.
So that line is the key. The court wasn't rejecting independence per se, it was rejecting unilateral independence by a single director. again, they weren't saying the idea of independence was unconstitutional. At the time, they doubled down on Humphrey's executor for multi-member commissions, but they drew a bright line. A single director with for-cause protection is too much unchecked power. So up to this point, that multi-layered system has been the only thing keeping independent agencies safe. And even that is unlikely to persist for much longer.
So what did the court then actually do?
They severed the removal restriction. They said the CFPB can stay, but the president has to be able to remove its director at will. It kept the agency alive, but under closer executive control. At the time, Roberts described it as the most recent chapter in a serious, ongoing conversation about the constitutional structure of the executive branch.
And that conversation isn't over.
No. And Celia Law itself didn't even stand alone for long. 2 years later, the court decided another case about a single director independent agency, Collins v. Yellen.
That was the case about the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Did the court strike down everything the FHFA had done?
No. The court said the removal restriction was unconstitutional, but it also made clear that not every action by an improperly insulated director would automatically get unwound. The plaintiffs would have to show actual harm from the removal protection itself.
So we're totally done with the idea of single director independent agencies.
Yes, absolutely no single director independent agencies. But if the court does strike down an agency claiming that the structure violates the separation of powers, that will not automatically undo everything the agency has done up to that point. And importantly, as of November 2025, Humphrey's executor is still good law. We just need to have a board, not an individual.
Which brings us to our present moment.
It does, because Trump v. Slaughter, the case the court is going to hear next week, asks whether even the classic multi-member commissions, the one that Humphrey's executor explicitly protected, can still be independent. And the stakes here are enormous. If the court narrows or overturns Humphrey's executor, as it almost certainly will, the entire architecture of independent agencies will shift. An oral argument is happening on December 8th.
So what is Trump v. Slaughter about?
Earlier this year, Trump fired two members of the Federal Trade Commission, Rebecca Slaughter and Alvarado Bedoyo. They were both Democrats. He argued that the FTC's removal protections were unconstitutional under Celia Law, and Slaughter sued, saying the law still protected her from being removed without cause.
And the court sides with her.
So far, yes. Lower courts aren't going to have a choice. The federal district court ordered her to be reinstated and pointing out that Humphrey's executor was still binding precedent. The D.C. Circuit agreed that the administration was unlikely to win on appeal, again, assuming Humphrey's executor is still good precedent. Then the Supreme Court stepped in, granting certiorari before judgment and fast-tracking the case.
So is this the direct collision between Roosevelt's 1930s case and Trump's 2020s presidency?
Yes. The justices are now going to explicitly decide, again, whether multi-member commissioners like the FTC still deserve insulation for presidential removal or whether that violates the separation of powers.
And that's a huge deal, right? Because if they strike down those protections...
Yes, it changes everything. The president gains at-will removal power over potentially every independent regulator. The SEC, the Federal Reserve, the NLRB, the FCC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The entire system of referees.
The entire game would look very different.
It would. So supporters, people who believe in the unitary executive theory, say that this would finally restore democratic accountability. If the president is the one responsible for executing the laws, and again, no question that's what the Constitution says, he should control the people who are supposed to execute the laws under him.
So everything we've discussed over these past two episodes
is potentially on the table. If the Supreme Court says Humphrey's executor was wrong, the president needs full control, suddenly all these independent protections disappear. Or they could potentially reaffirm that some decisions still need to be insulated from political pressure.
The stakes really couldn't be higher.
That's why we're watching this case so closely.
So next episode, we'll talk through what happened in the argument and what it could mean for the administrative state, whether we're watching the death of Humphrey's executor or if some independents may still hold on by a thread.
Right. The justices repeatedly said they think the Fed is different, likely because of the concern that we've been reiterating over these two episodes. So that might be the only independent entity left standing. So on the next episode, we'll be talking through the case. After that, we will move on to the major questions doctrine.
So that does it for today's episode on administrative remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law, because remember, you can't fix what you don't understand.